Obviously no one, unless they had seen the letters that I had seen. Nor is this the only case. A fellow worker of mine told me of two precisely similar ones which had come to her knowledge in connection with Mr. X, which make the honest investigator of occult phenomena thankful that there is upon our statute book a law which enables magistrates to deal effectually with occultists who prostitute their powers. It is so generally known that no initiate may use the occult arts for gain that it is difficult to sympathize with people who pay some advertising occultist his half, crown or half, guinea and then find themselves let in for unpleasantness. What conclusions may we draw from the incidents that I have related, for the facts of which I can vouch from personal knowledge? Four women are persuaded to embark upon a meditation process whose aim is to pour out force. The nature of the force that is to be poured out is indicated by the fact that the married women are instructed not to live with their husbands and the unmarried girl is encouraged to fall in love with the man who is made the focus of the operation. This man is the head of a group of people known to be occupied with practical occultism and ceremonial. The conclusion I draw is that an occult experiment was afoot, and that, regardless of the consequences to them, these women were being made use of in order to carry it out, the procurer being the well-known psychic, Mr. X, and the operator the notorious Mr. Z. The same group have to their credit a recurring series of scandals in connection with unnatural vice. If this were merely vice as such, it would not come within the purview of these pages, but it appears to be used systematically as a means of obtaining occult power. Those who have any knowledge of the deeper aspects of occultism know that sex force is one of the manifestations of Kundalini, the serpent, fire that according to tantric philosophy lies coiled at the base of the spine, or in the terms of Western occultism, the sacral plexus. The control and concentration of the Kundalini force is an important part of the technique of practical occultism. There is a right way of directing it through thought, control, the technique of which I have explained in my little book, The Problem of Purity, Rider. But there is also another method, which consists in stimulating this force, and then directing it into abnormal channels where it will not be absorbed, but remain available for magical purposes. It is for this reason that in certain forms of the Black Mass the altar is the naked body of a woman who may either be still living, or have been slain sacrificially. A. E. W. Mason gives an account of such a transaction in his book, The Prisoner in the Opal. Less expert operators, however, cannot control this form of force. As soon as they generate it, it has to go to its logical conclusion. They therefore employ another type of stimulus, not the woman, but the boy or youth. The practice of pederasty in connection with occultism is very old, and was one of the causes of the degeneration of the Greek mysteries. I have dealt with these subjects in some detail in another book of mine, Sane Occultism. Particulars of the actual cases can be found by reference to the Files of Truth, the journal already referred to. Chapter 19. The Motives of Psychic Attack. It is a matter of general knowledge among occultists that it is not a pleasant thing to fall foul of an occult fraternity of which one has been made a member by means of a ceremonial initiation and to which one is bound by oaths. As we have already seen, the malignant mind of a trained occultist is a nasty weapon, how much more so the group mind formed out of a number of trained minds, especially if concentrated by means of ritual. But in addition to the individual mental force of the members of a fraternity, and in addition to the collective force of its group, mind, there is another factor to be reckoned with when a genuine occult organization is concerned in operations of either protection or destruction. Every occult organization depends for its power to initiate upon what are called its contacts, that is to say, upon one or more of its leaders being psychically in touch with certain forces. If, in addition to this, the organization has a long line of tradition behind it, a very potent collection of thought, forms will be built up in its atmosphere. Every initiation ceremony contains in some form or other the oath of the mysteries, which binds the candidate neither to reveal the secrets of the mysteries nor to abuse the knowledge they bestow. This oath always contains a penalty clause and an invocation wherein the candidate submits himself to a penalty in the event of a breach of faith, and calls upon some being to exact the penalty. Some of these oaths are most formidable affairs, and they are administered with every circumstance of solemnity that stage management can devise. The way in which the occult fraternities have succeeded in preserving their secrets shows how seldom these oaths are broken. In the event of a dispute with an occult fraternity, the force invoked in this oath may come into action automatically. If the recalcitrant brother is in the spirit of the tradition and it is his chiefs who are at fault, the power invoked in the oath will be a potent protective influence with which the chiefs themselves will collide. If, on the other hand, he breaks faith with the mysteries, this avenging punitive current will come into action although his defection may pass undiscovered. I was informed by an eye witness of an incident which took place at an initiation, in which the candidate, a man to all appearances normal in every way, after taking the oath in the usual manner, suddenly screamed most terribly, startling everyone, and was ill for some weeks as if from a severe nervous shock, and never had anything more to do with occultism. No explanation of the incident was ever forthcoming. I was present myself upon one occasion when a batch of 3 candidates was being done, and it was suddenly noticed in the course of the ceremony that the number of the candidates had become reduced to 2. Inquiry elicited the fact that the 3rd had taken fright and fled. What happened in these 2 cases, I do not know. Whether there had been a breach of good faith, or whether one was intended, no one can say, but something put the fear of the Lord into these 2 individuals pretty effectually. That no such shock is inherent in the ceremony is proved by the fact that these are the only 2 cases in my experience, and I have seen a very large number of ceremonies. I felt as if I had come into harbor after a stormy voyage. Another man who was intimately known to me as an advanced occultist was turned out of the order to which he belonged. Why, I do not know, but from what I saw of him I should imagine there were plenty of reasons. In defiance of his initiation oath he began to work an independent lodge. He was warned to desist, and did so, dismantling his temple. But he immediately began to get together another temple in a carefully concealed place, and this time he was more ambitious, for he made ready to attempt the greater mysteries. He was an exceedingly clever craftsman and made all the equipment of the temple with his own hands so that no one should know what was afoot. Concealed behind Nottingham lace curtains in a mean street in West London was a beautiful little temple of the greater mysteries. He completed this work after some months of arduous toil, no one knowing of it save those in his immediate confidence. But before commencing the actual ritual work he went away for a short holiday at the seaside, and there he was seized with a heart attack while sitting on the beach and died in 4 hours. The order secrets were not betrayed. Another man who had had a dispute with the same famous order, printed and published their secrets as an act of revenge. He was a man of good social position, considerable wealth and brilliant literary abilities, already making a name for himself as a writer. From that moment he began to go downhill, and came to poverty and disgrace. The curse of Ahasuerus seemed to be upon him, and he was hounded from country to country, finding no abiding place. No publisher will handle his books, no paper will review them. Let me finally tell of my own experiences in an astral skirmish. I wrote a series of articles on the abuses prevalent in the occult fraternities, and these were published in the Occult Review. My writing is largely inspirational, a great deal coming through of which I have no previous knowledge, and in this particular case I evidently shot a great deal better than I knew, and got myself into serious trouble. My first intimation of it was a sense of uneasiness and restlessness. Next came a feeling as if the barriers between the seen and the unseen were full of rifts and I kept on getting glimpses of the astral mingling with my waking consciousness. This, for me, is unaccustomed, for I am not naturally psychic, and in the technique in which I was trained we are taught to keep the different levels of consciousness strictly separate and to use a specific method for opening and closing the gates. Consequently one seldom gets spontaneous psychism. One's vision resembles the use of a microscope in which one examines prepared material. The general sense of vague uneasiness gradually matured into a definite sense of menace and antagonism, and presently I began to see demon faces in flashes, resembling those picture images which psychologists call by the unpleasing name of hypnagogics, flashes of dream which appear upon the threshold of sleep. I was quite unsuspicious of any particular individual, though I realized that my articles had probably stirred somebody up pretty thoroughly. What was my surprise, then, to receive from a person whom I looked upon as a friend and for whom I had the greatest respect, a letter which left me in no doubt whatever as to the source of the attack and what I might expect if any more articles were published. I can honestly say that until I received this letter I had not the slightest suspicion that this person was implicated in the scandals I was attacking. I was in a somewhat difficult position. I had fired off a charge of shrapnel on general principles, and had apparently bagged a number of my friends and associates and fluttered the dove coat generally. My position was rather complicated by the fact that I did not know nearly as much as they apparently suspected me of doing. I had, of course, known that these abuses existed sporadically about the occult field, as everybody in the movement knows. But to know in this vague way is one thing, and to put one's finger on specific cases is another. I had evidently blundered into something much more considerable than I had bargained for. I felt like the small boy who, fishing for minnows, has hooked a pike. I had to decide whether I would try and get my articles back from the occult review, or whether I would let them run their natural course and take the consequences. I had had a very strong impulse to write those articles, and now I began to see why I had had it. I shall have something to say in another chapter concerning the Watchers, that curious section of the occult hierarchy which is concerned with the welfare of nations. A certain section of their work is apparently concerned with the policing of the astral plane. Very little is actually known about them. One comes across their work sporadically and pieces the bits together. I have crossed their trail on several occasions, as I will tell later. Whenever black magic is afoot, they set to work to put a spoke in its wheels. Be that as it may, I came to the conclusion that, in view of what had now transpired, the impulse I had had to take in hand this piece of work might have emanated from the Watchers. At any rate, the work obviously needed doing. Someone had to tackle these plague spots if they were to be cleared up, so I determined to stick to my guns and see the matter through, and so left the articles in question to run their course. Very soon some curious things began to happen. We became most desperately afflicted with black cats. They were not hallucinatory cats, for our neighbors shared in the affliction, and we exchanged commiserations with the caretaker next door who was engaged in pushing bunches of black cats off doorstep and window, sill with a broom, and declared he had never in his life seen so many, or such dreadful specimens. The whole house was filled with the horrible stench of the brutes. Two members of our community at the time went out to business every day, and at their offices, in different parts of London, they found the same penetrating reek of the tom cat. At first we attributed this persecution to natural causes, and concluded that we were near neighbors to some fascinating feline female, but incidents succeeded each other which made us feel that things were not quite in the ordinary course of nature. We were getting near to the vernal equinox, which is always a difficult time for occultists. There was a sense of strain and tension in the atmosphere, and we were all feeling decidedly uncomfortable. Coming upstairs after breakfast one morning, I suddenly saw, coming down the stairs towards me, a gigantic tabby cat, twice the size of a tiger. It appeared absolutely solid and tangible. I stared at it petrified for a second, and then it vanished. I instantly realized that it was a simulacrum, or thought, form that was being projected by someone with occult powers. Not that the realization was any too comforting, but it was better than an actual tiger. Feeling decidedly uncomfortable, I asked one of my household to join me, and as we sat in my room meditating we heard the cry of a cat from without. It was answered by another, and another. We looked out of the window, and the street as far as we could see was dotted with black cats, and they were wailing and howling in broad daylight as they do on the roofs at night. I rose up, gathered together my paraphernalia, and did an exorcism then and there. At the end we looked out of the window again. There was not a cat in sight, and we never saw them again. The visitation was at an end. Only a normal population of local mousers remained to us. The vernal equinox was now upon us. I must explain that this is the most important season of the year for occultists. Great power, tides are flowing on the inner planes, and these are very difficult to handle. If there is going to be astral trouble, it usually blows up for storm at this season. There are also certain meetings which take place on the astral plane, and many occultists attend them out of the body. In order to do this, one has to throw oneself into a trance, and then the mind is free to travel. It is usual to get someone who understands these methods of work to watch beside the body while it is vacated to see that it comes to no harm. In the ordinary way, when an occult attack is afoot, one clings to waking consciousness at all costs, sleeping by day and keeping awake and meditating while the sun is below the horizon. As ill luck would have it, however, I was obliged to make one of these astral journeys at this season. My attacker knew this as well as I did. I therefore made my preparations with all the precautions I could think of, gathered together a carefully chosen group to form the watching circle, and sealed up the place of operation with the usual ceremonial. I had not much faith in this operation under the circumstances, for my attacker was of much higher grade than I was, and could come through any seals I might set. However, it afforded protection against minor unpleasantness. The method of making these astral journeys is highly technical, and I cannot enter upon it here. In the language of psychology, it is auto-hypnosis by means of a symbol. The symbol acts as a door to the unseen. According to the symbol chosen will be the section of the unseen to which access is obtained. The trained initiate, therefore, does not wander on the astral like an uneasy ghost, but comes and goes by well-known corridors. My enemy's task was therefore not a difficult one, for she knew about the time I must make this journey and the symbol I must use in order to get out of the body. I was therefore prepared for opposition, though I did not know what form it would take. These astral journeys are really lucid dreams in which one retains all one's faculties of choice, will, power and judgment. Mine always begin with a curtain of the symbolic color through whose folds I pass. No sooner was I through the curtain on this occasion than I saw my enemy waiting for me, or, if another terminology is preferred, I began to dream about her. She appeared to me in the full robes of her grade, which were very magnificent, and barred my entry, telling me that by virtue of her authority she forbade me to make use of these astral pathways. I replied that I did not admit her right to close the astral paths to me because she was personally offended, and that I appealed to the inner chiefs, to whom both she and I were responsible. Then ensued a battle of wills in which I experienced the sensation of being whirled through the air and falling from a great height and found myself back in my body. But my body was not where I had left it, but in a heap in the far corner of the room, which looked as if it had been bombed. By means of the well-known phenomenon of repercussion, the astral struggle had apparently communicated itself to the body, which had somersaulted round the room while an agitated group had rescued the furniture from its path. I was somewhat shaken by this experience, which had not been a pleasant one. I recognized that I had had the worst of it and had been effectually ejected from the astral paths, but I also realized that if I accepted this defeat, my occult career was at an end. Just as a child who has been thrown by his pony must immediately get up and remount if he is ever to ride again, so I knew that at all costs I must make that astral journey if I were to retain my powers. So I told my group to pull themselves together and reform the circle because we must make another attempt. I invoked the inner chiefs, and went out once more. This time there was a short sharp struggle, and I was through. I had the vision of the inner chiefs, and returned. The fight was over. I have never had any trouble since. But when I took off my clothes in order to go to bed, my back felt very sore, and taking a hand, glass I examined it in the mirror, and I found that from neck to waist I was scored with scratches as if I had been clawed by a gigantic cat. I told this story to some friends of mine, experienced occultists, who at one time had been closely associated with the person with whom I had had this trouble, and they told me that she was well known for these astral attacks, and that a friend of theirs after a quarrel with her had had an exactly similar experience, and she too had been covered with claw marks. In her case, however, she had been ill for 6 months and had never touched occultism again. There is a curious epilogue to this story, which may or may not have any bearing upon it. I have already told the story of the mysterious death that took place on Iona, how the body of this unfortunate girl was found lying naked on a cross cut out of the turf. No cause of death could be found, and the verdict was that she died of exposure. But if she were lost, how did she come to lie down to die in this ritual manner, instead of wandering about? Why had she taken off all her clothes before leaving her house, covering herself only with a black cloak? And why did she take with her the large knife with which she cut the cross in the turf? I do not know her later history, for I had lost sight of her during the last 2 or 3 years of her life, but at the time I knew her she was associated with the woman I have referred to. The only marks found upon her dead body were scratches. Page 71 of 103. Part 4. Methods of Defense Against Psychic Attack. Chapter 15. Physical Aspect of Psychic Attack and Defense. We have distinguished the various types of psychic attack, we have described the methods that can be employed in carrying them out, and we have also noted the various forms of delusion, fraud and auto suggestion that may complicate the issue. We are now in a position to discuss the question of diagnosis. Let us consider the whole matter from the practical point of view. Supposing a stranger comes with a story of a psychic attack, what should be our procedure? We must first of all bear in mind that there is great need of caution in presuming that a psychic attack is being made. Psychic attacks are comparatively rare things. We must not assume we are dealing with one until we have excluded all the other things it can possibly be. Not so long ago I came across a case of alleged obsession which turned out to be neglected constipation, and which was effectually exorcised with castor oil. If there are any physical symptoms at all, even if they are no more than a bad color or a bad breath, a diagnosis ought to be made by a qualified medical practitioner. For even if the trouble have a predominating psychic element, its origin may be physical. Septic foci are really centers of decomposition, and as such they open the door to low forms of elemental life whose function is to assist in the return of dust to dust. Impurities in the blood stream may poison the brain. New growths or abscesses may derange its functions. These things can only be recognized by the man who understands the body, other things being equal, the trained man is the better man, and the man with the best training is the best man, and the only place where an adequate training in diagnosis can be obtained is a general hospital. Moreover, should things turn out badly, the only person who can pull the chestnuts out of the fire is the person whose signature the authorities will accept on a certificate. Supposing the patient turns out to be a lunatic, what is the unqualified practitioner going to do with him? A very large proportion of the cases of alleged psychic attack turn out to be lunatics and hysterics. Incipient lunacy is a very hard thing to detect, hysteria is very cunning and plausible. A doctor who is handling human nature in bulk every day of his life will detect either of these two conditions much quicker than the layman who has never met them before. It may be objected that it is a very difficult thing to find a doctor who will have a sympathetic attitude towards occultism. To argue thus is to misunderstand the position. The doctor is not being asked to cooperate with any occult operation, but to examine for physical disease, and if he finds it, to treat it. He is no more concerned in the occult measures that are taken for the benefit of his patients than he is in the church his patient attends. If the doctor finds no evidence of organic disease, or some complaint such as varicose veins which can obviously have no bearing on the mental condition, the case may be held to have passed the first test, and we may feel that it is worthwhile to proceed to the psychic investigation, if the case is a bad one, or the trouble is of long standing. The doctor will probably find that the patient is debilitated, even if there is nothing definitely amiss, and will proceed to treat the condition accordingly. This is all to the good, for the better the physical condition of the patient, the more mental control and stamina he will have. Sleeping, drafts, however, should be avoided if possible, and if they have to be administered, then the patient should be watched while he sleeps by someone who knows how to keep an occult guard, and the room in which he sleeps should be purified and sealed. In the ordinary way, if a person who is out on the astral meets with an occult attack, he bolts back to his body like a rabbit to its burrow and wakes up as if from a nightmare. But if the sleep is made unnaturally deep by a sleeping draft, he cannot wake up, and is locked out on the astral, as it were, which is the last thing one wants in the case of a psychic attack. If a sleeping draft is considered essential, for it is impossible to go without sleep indefinitely, the person who is watching beside the sleeper should observe carefully any signs that the sleep is being disturbed by dreams, and if he observes muttering or twitching, should immediately perform the necessary banishings and whisper into the ear of the sleeper soothing and reassuring suggestions, such as Ku recommends should be done in the case of young children. One of the most distressing features of a psychic attack is that the victim fears to sleep because he feels that in sleep he is defenseless. Those who have read Kipling's terrible story, the end of the passage, may remember that the victim of the occult attack therein described always went to bed wearing spurs in order that he might rowel himself and so wake up if he were struggling with his invisible enemy during sleep. There is a great deal that can be done upon the physical plane to help the person who is suffering from an occult attack, and we may as well consider these physical methods while we are upon the subject of the part that can be played by a doctor in dealing with the case. Sunlight is exceedingly valuable because it strengthens the aura and makes it much more resistant. People are often advised to go away into the country on this account, but for the victim of an occult attack to go into the depths of the country may not be the wisest thing, because elemental forces are much more potent away from towns, and if he is threatened by an uprush of atavistic forces, he had better cling to the haunts of men. The sea, too, is an elemental force that is best avoided, for water is an element intimately associated with psychism. Large bodies of water and high mountains should be avoided in choosing a health resort for a person suffering from psychic trouble. The best place is an inland spa. Games, physical training, massage, anything that improves the bodily condition, are invaluable. But long solitary walks should be avoided because there is often a risk of suicide. The person who is the victim of an occult attack should at all costs avoid solitude. There is another very simple measure which gives immense relief in cases of psychic interference. It is obvious that the attack is made through the psychic centers, therefore anything which closes those centers will render the victim comparatively immune. It is well known how the stolid, materialistic type of person can live with impunity in haunted houses that drive the sensitive to madness and suicide. It is also well known that psychic work cannot be performed if there is food in the stomach. The best results are always obtained when fasting. The obvious corollary of these facts is that if we want to keep the psychic centers closed, we should not allow the stomach to become empty. The person who is facing a psychic attack should not go more than 2 hours without food. Certain important psychic centers are in the head. One of the simplest ways of checking their activity is by drawing the blood down from the head. This can be done effectually by a hot bath or putting the feet in hot mustard and water. Another important center is the solar plexus. During a psychic attack, this is often felt to be tense and distressing. A large hot water bottle, well filled so that it is heavy as well as hot, laid upon the solar plexus, which is the hand breadth between the pit of the stomach and the ribs, will effectually relieve tension in that spot. Indeed, pressure without heat will give relief, and I have known cases where a firm pad held in place by a belt or corsets gave much comfort. Above all things, the bowels should be kept freely opened while facing a psychic attack, because there is nothing that puts one at so great a disadvantage as the accumulation of effete matter within the body. All these simple physical remedies are readily available. They will not afford a cure for psychic pathologies, nor a complete defense from psychic attack, but they can give great relief from distress. They enable the victim to put up a much more effectual resistance, and by relieving the strain, they increase his endurance.